Hi everyone, my name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. So in We Agnostics, I'm not sure what page this is on for you, but it's the paragraph that starts with, "We know how he feels." I will pause a moment while you find the place.
Page 45.
45 already, huh? "We know how he feels. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice. Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. Perhaps we reject this particular conception because it seemed inadequate. With that rejection, we imagine we abandoned the God idea entirely. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. We looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, an inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance at many individuals who claimed to be godly. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it all? And who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? Yet, in other moments, we found ourselves thinking, when enchanted by a starlit night, who then made all this? There was a feeling of awe and wonder, but it was fleeting and soon lost." There's not much difference between the manuscript and the big book, except for a couple of grammatical changes in this paragraph. And I know exactly what they're talking about. Coming into this fellowship, the two times that I came into this fellowship, I had the experience of being broken, the real gift of being absolutely and undeniably broken. Every single thing that I had tried had failed. All the things that I thought were important didn't actually bring about any sort of relief in my life. And I chased those things with greater fervor and greater desire and greater energy, and they kept failing me in worse and worse ways. But only if I could just figure out a way of making that work, it would somehow tomorrow make this world better off. But what seemed to be the problem was not that I wasn't doing it right. It was that you guys weren't doing your job right. And in this period of time, I kept looking inside of myself, what do I need to do to make this world a good place for me? At no place was there a concept of God. At no place was this idea that God was in my life. I knew God left me on the side of the road. I didn't necessarily believe that God didn't exist, but I had this feeling that God existed for you and would never exist for me. And there was no chance that God was going to work in my life and be a viable part of my life because I suffered from alcoholism. And the world looks a very strange way when I suffer from alcoholism. I had a lot of intellectual pride when it came to assessing whether or not God was in my life or not. I had a lot of ability to figure things out, and I had figured out that God wasn't there. I had that honest doubt. And I had prejudice too, because I knew, you know, I had watched on TV, one of the things that they didn't have when this manuscript was written, they didn't have CNN, you know, when they'd be dragging the preacher out of the hotel room followed by the 14-year-old boy, or they, you know, the guy had was driving the Rolls Royce after getting money from his congregation, or some other thing that satisfied the little bit that I needed to have to justify why they were wrong. And if you believed in them, you were wrong too. I didn't have any belief that the fundamental underpinnings of anyone's particular faith, religion, denomination, or anything else had much value whatsoever. And if you found yourself aligned with that, you had to be a sheep. You had to be something, you know, somebody who just needed that I didn't need that, because I was going to figure out the things that were going to work for me. I wasn't going to fall into that trap of being this mindless, you know, frontal lobotomy kind of guy who just went blindly with faith. And what ended up happening was I was forced into a corner of pain and suffering. I was forced into a corner where this stuff had to be looked at in a different light. It's impossible for me to accurately make a realistic assessment about what God looks like in my life when I am completely and utterly full of fear. There is no room in my heart when my heart is full of fear. There is no room in my heart when my heart is full of prejudice. Prejudice, by definition, for me is fear, right? I am really afraid of you. I'm afraid of what your belief brings, right? So what I've got to do is I've got to make you guys wrong. See, that satisfies one of my character defects. Every single thing that makes makes the delusion justifiable is putting you people into a wrong place. So I come into this fellowship twice, and the second time, I knew that I couldn't blame alcohol anymore because I hadn't been drinking for 2 years. You know, I was at the bottom of a spiritual abyss, and I kind of was broken in a way I had never been broken before, because it was easy to come in the rooms previously when I was broken from drinking and be able to blame the drinking. You know, that was my problem. If I could just get separated from the drinking, somehow that, then everything would be okay again, because it was the drinking that was the problem. That's what I thought. And my best of thinking brought me to the idea that somehow that was going to be the solution, getting separated. And for a long time, getting separated seemed to be a pretty solid way to live. But it wasn't enough, right? And I end up migrating back to the thought that I'm going to manage and control this stuff. The second time that I came in here, I understood that managing and controlling this stuff did not work, because that is what brought me to these rooms. Utterly and completely deflated, my ego had finally been banished to the corner, beaten into submission, not by me but by the truth. And I thought the truth was something that came out of my ability to somehow now use my rational mind to understand the world a little bit better. But the truth for me is the exit of self and the entry of God. Right? The closer I get, the more the truth is opened up and made available to me, the more I realize that what's really happened is that self has started to seep away. Self doesn't seep away for me simply because it's getting tough. Because I will fight the getting tough part. I will fight back and try and figure out how to be right. Because being wrong is the story of my life, and I don't like it. So what happens in the second time coming back, self no longer really had footing. And the things that were going on in your life that seemed to make you happy started to become the truth of what was out there. And I'm only going to be willing to and able to accept a little bit of the truth at one point. Because it conflicts so solidly with everything that is who I am that I cannot abandon self entirely. And the book talks about abandoning self entirely. And I can't do that out of the gate. I can't figure out a way to abandon self entirely because that is not who I am. So it's got to come from inches and movements. It's got to come from watching you guys have a new experience. It's got to come from reading things like this and understanding that it's possible that what has occurred is that I've carried with me my entire life a false understanding of what my life looks like. That alcohol is a rational response to the alcoholism that's inside of me. I found the in this paragraph it talks about perhaps we rejected this particular conception because it seemed inadequate. And that was the truth for me, because no matter what had ever happened, the times that I had gone to a religious function, somebody got married, somebody died, I showed up. I used to go to Baroque concerts at Christmas time. You know, I'd walk into these grand cathedrals in Manhattan, you know, in December to watch these people sing these wonderful choruses, and I would be moved by it, like a Winchester Cathedral experience for Bill. But I would leave. Because I knew somehow it wasn't going to solve my problem. It wasn't a sufficient solution to what was ailing me. I had to think that problem through. Yes, if we have agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences, let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and even express a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. Who here feels as though they came in here with a solid understanding of what God was? I see no hands up. Who here came in here with a solid religious background? Who here today feels as though they have a better understanding of God? Right, almost every hand is up. Right? Did that come about because you decided to go to rabbinical college or to take the priesthood, or is it? Did you throw yourself into the being the collection plate person at the Sunday meeting, or did you find that somehow in a room full of people where you could slip a dollar into a basket and have a warm cup of semi-dishwater coffee? Right? It's odd. The spiritual awakening comes to me from places that I have no idea it's going to come from. It comes from the truck driver who has spent his entire life, you know, rewriting himself and making amends and sitting across from the fellow at the diner who's made the meetings, who's read the literature, who's actually put into practice things that have happened in his life. And he starts to change. He starts to have a psychic change about himself. And it comes about in ways that are amazing. Because it really is a simple process. It was a simple process for me. And it was about getting honest about where I was and who I was. What is the inventory process? What is the amends process? But a process of saying, this is what truly happened. I've got to get to the truth of this matter because the falsehoods have been killing me all along. You know, my sponsor is this goofy guy who keeps throwing... who keeps throwing stuff at me, you know. Oh, here, read this book. It's about the way they interpreted the Christian religion between the year 350 and 450. And it has to do with Constantine. You'll get a lot out of it. Thank you. You know, take this book on Buddhism. You know, after the ecstasy, the laundry. You know, things like that. And what I would do is I'd look at him and go, well, thanks, Chris. And then I'd think to myself, he's insane. This is awesome. But what would happen is I would start to read these things that were shut off from me, things that didn't make any sense to me, things that the narrow-minded people read on the train. And I'd read a little bit, and all of a sudden I'd go, you know, that is the truth, isn't it? That is the truth. And then I was introduced to somebody who literally changed my world, and it was a man named Thomas Merton. And he was a prolific writer. And the vast majority of the stuff that I've read by Thomas Merton doesn't include his religion, but it includes how he got to his understanding of God. And that was a real eye-opener for me because I suddenly started to realize I could have my own conception as God as long as I was willing and honest to go down the path to find out what that was. I cannot go down... It's like hoarding, right? How am I ever going to find the bathroom in the house where I have newspapers stacked to the ceiling? I've got to start emptying the house of the derrititis of my existence. I have to start emptying the house of the lies that I've built up about what this looks like. I have to start emptying the house of my preconceived notion about what life looks like, how I'm supposed to act, how you guys are supposed to act, and what this world looks like. And until I start emptying the hallways, I'm never going to find the bathroom. I'm never going to find the places. But when I do, it becomes this amazing experience because I get a little taste and a little touch of what it looks like, and others have shown me the way. People that, you know, you would never go to say, you know, I want to have my child baptized, Chris. Would you do it in our bathtub? No, you wouldn't do that, right? You wouldn't come to AA and look for somebody to bring about a spiritual awakening in your home, but this is where I get it. And it's the craziest idea I've ever come across, right? Because this place is not one where you would normally... think that God resides, but God resides within inside of us. And the answer is that we're not God. So it was putting aside the prejudice and becoming willing to take a journey I had never taken before and just doing it little by little. I could never sit down and finish the book, but I could read a little bit. And I found myself reading parts over and over again. And at my age, it's great because you forget the stuff. You get to read it again. And it would have a new meaning. And the next day, it was just like the big book. You'd read another sentence, you'd read another paragraph, and you go, oh my God, it means something different to me today. And I would highlight these things, and I would look at them, and they would change my perception. And I would read a single paragraph by Merton, and I would find that in there was something that I would have to think about for an hour, and he would cover it in three sentences, and it just blew the top of my head off. And it wasn't just Merton, but it was a variety of other authors, you know Mark Nepo, the Book of Awakening, a man who was going through cancer, who had sat down and looked at his life and changed his life based upon the fact that he was dying, right? Not an alcoholic, right? I come into the rooms dying. Right, and I'm looking for an answer. You guys have it. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with Him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed by a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive, or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. Now, forbidding to those who earnestly seek was added to the manuscript to be put into the big book. What is that paragraph telling me? Right? That I don't even have an idea of what it looks like on the other side. Broad and roomy was not my life in the end. My life was narrow, constrained, frightening, painful, consumed with self, and consumed with alcohol. And it was consumed with whatever it took to maintain that lifestyle. And when I came in the second time, it was all consumed about how do I protect who I am against the truth. It's a simple requirement. Am I willing to earnestly seek? Am I truly willing to even become to believe? And it is in that crack that what starts to fade out, what starts to seep out, is self. It is in that crack that what starts to go is all the things that have kept me from being with you people and with God. And by definition, if I can't be with you and I can't be with God, I can't be with myself. And am I living as somebody who doesn't really exist? I've never found my true nature. A friend of mine posted on Facebook, I'm going to out there to seek to bring hope. And the funny thing was, when that person posted that, the first thing that I thought to myself, that is your nature. Right? They're always out there trying to be of service. And I know that that's not the way that I was seen for many, many years. I was a bringer of calamity, not serenity. In everything that I did, if you talked to me, you were wondering what my angle was. If you talked to me, you knew that somehow I was going to get to the part in the conversation where I wanted something. That any sort of discussion about, hey, how you doing, was false and wasn't genuine. I wanted something from you. And it took years for me to even realize in Alcoholics Anonymous that had continued after I came in. I had to take a long, hard look at how that was. And that process of wanting something from me in every interaction I had was one of the falsehoods that had to go because it doesn't allow God into my life. Because it's a show run by Dave. You want to start?
Sure. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Chris. You know, spirituality, recovery, I believe, is more about unlearning and more about letting go of than it is about gaining access to the truth. You know, as alcoholics, we really want to know in a very simple way. And when it comes to spiritual concepts, when it comes to concepts like the existence of God, it's very, very difficult to understand that intellectually. It's more of an experience. I had a teacher about 10 years ago, and I learned a great deal from this teacher. He told me this story. He was in Australia, and there was a high lama, a very, very prestigious high lama, Buddhist monk, high lama, coming over, and he was going to give a talk at this Buddhist retreat center. And he went there, and he got there early so he can sit in the front row. And you know, everybody's talking about how unbelievable this guy is. This guy's going to talk about God, and it's going to be unbelievable. And the whole auditorium fills up with people, and Joe's sitting up in the front row. And this lama comes out, and you can just feel the spirituality coming off of this guy. And he says, he sits down, and then he says, "There is no God." And everybody goes, "What?" And he says it again. He goes, "There is no God. There is only godliness." And he said his whole conception shifted in that moment from seeing God as a noun to understanding God as a verb. As alcoholics, we're told that powerlessness, lack of power, is our dilemma. We must seek a power greater than ourselves that will restore us to sanity. You know, that's what we're told. So Bill was very intuitive. He was not that spiritually advanced, but man, he got it right. He saw and he understood God as a power. Something that can work in you and through you. Not necessarily a wizened old white-haired gentleman up on a throne up in heaven, you know, as separate from, but God as part of. working in and through us. And he told me another story. He goes, Chris, so many of us are like, you know, we're like fish swimming around in the ocean, going, you know, saying, you know, where are you going, fish? And the fish says, I'm looking for water. They said this thing called water was really amazing, you know. And as individuals, as parts of the human experience, we're swimming around in the water. You know, look, you know, where is God? We've got to find God. You know, we are God. You know, God is in us and through us and part of our experience. And the problem with an alcoholic is we're in our own way. It's our faulty belief systems and the things that the bad things that we've erected within ourselves, our own distorted views of the world that have started to block us off. I love what Bill says in this. He goes, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice, you know, that's why we say the set-aside prayer in the beginning of this meeting. It's because if you bring your belief systems in here and you already know, you're not going to learn anything. You're not going to move forward. The Buddhists call the state of mind that you need to have as a student the beginner's mind. And if you look at Zen teaching, you know, the Zen master will ask somebody a question and the person will answer it and they'll slap them across the face. You know, it's like what they want to do is they want to stop you from always answering things like you already know. You know, this spirituality, this spiritual growth and this experience with God is something that we truly do have to experience. Alcoholics Anonymous is about two things. It's about power and it's about freedom. We're talking about power now because we're in the chapter We Agnostics. The consciousness of the presence of God. They talk about that in our text. Seeking through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Those are very heavy terms. Conscious contact with God. The consciousness of the presence of God in our lives. The difference between faith. Oh, I believe in God, and you know, and I believe in Jesus, and I, you know, I say my prayers. The difference between that and the consciousness of the presence of God in your life is like the difference between night and day. And we're offered this in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what's amazing. You know, we've got a progressively fatal illness, and the solution to this illness is an experience with God. I mean, you know. Listen, if you're suffering from cholera, you know, you're not gonna have you know, the people who are treating you for cholera are not gonna say, you know, you're gonna have an experience with God and you're gonna know a new freedom and a new happiness. That's not what happens when you get treatment for cholera. We're very, very lucky that, you know, what we have is alcoholism. It's a spiritual illness. So the recovery is spiritual. And the longer I'm sober and the more recovery I experience, the more gratitude I have for that. Because the treatment for alcoholism is about your whole life just getting better every day. The most satisfactory years of your existence are ahead of you. That's one of the promises in this book. That's a powerful promise. That means every single day is going to get better if you continue to practice these principles in all your affairs. Every year is going to get better than the next, and that's been my experience. You know, I'm in my 24th year. It's better than my 23rd was, and the 23rd was better than the 22nd. You know, this is a cumulative. The gifts of this spiritual experience. When therefore? Yep. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. Again, why are they saying that? They're saying that because they don't want you to be prejudiced about thinking that someone is going to put a conception on God that you're not going to be able to deal with. They want you to be able to start where you are, because on the spiritual plane, you have to start where you are. You know, you can't jump ahead to, you know, step 10. You have to start where you are. So whatever conception of God you have, you can start there. But it's going to broaden and deepen with the practice of these steps. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. Again, they want you to have a beginner's mind. They don't want you to have that intellectual arrogance of, you know what, I'm a Catholic or I'm a Methodist or I know. Well, if you knew, you wouldn't be dying of alcoholism. You know, if you had an effective spiritual life, you wouldn't be in trouble with alcoholism. Because an effective spiritual life is the treatment for alcoholism. So open your mind to some new concepts. Listen, a lot of religious people show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of good religious people show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the faith that's the problem. It's the application of the spiritual principles in your life that needs to happen. At the start, this is all you will need to commence spiritual growth. To affect your first conscious relation with God as you understand Him. Afterward, you will find yourself accepting many things which now seem entirely out of reach. That is growth. But if you're going to grow, you have to begin somewhere. So use your own conception, however limited that may be. You need ask yourself but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Now, does this mean God? I'm sure that it does. You know, we need to ask ourselves, do we believe in God? But do we believe in God as a power? Do we believe in God as an interventionary force that can create change in our life? That's what we need. My conception of God when I first got sober was there might have been a God who put the world together and, he's keeping Jupiter on its axis, but it's certainly not messing with me, because if God was messing with me, my life wouldn't be so bad. So I didn't see that there was a God that could interact in a positive way in my life. I blocked myself off from that belief. Today I've experienced the power of God in my life. So again, we have to have an open mind. As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. This was great news to us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. Set aside you're prejudiced against spiritual concepts or religion. Set it aside. That does not mean get rid of it. That means just take it and put it off to the side, because it's going to get in your way of understanding a spirituality that's going to be effective in treatment for alcoholism. You know, it's what we know sometimes that block us off from positive growth. When people presented us with spiritual approaches, how frequently did we all say, I wish I had what that man has. I'm sure it would work if I could only believe as he believes. But I cannot accept as surely true the many articles of faith which are so plain to him. So it was comforting to learn that we could commence at a simpler level. It's unfortunate that so much of our religious documents and books and worship material... are so old. A lot of times it's very, very difficult for people who grew up in the 20th century, the 21st century now, to look back at the Bible or something like that that was written thousands of years ago and feel drawn into it. Sometimes, I know when I first got sober, I'll tell this story. When I first got sober, I saw step two up there on the wall. I saw step three up there on the wall. And I said to myself, oh man, that's not good news. That's not good news. I got sober when Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were selling, 4,000 heavenly condos when there was only 2,000. They were robbing people. And Jimmy Swaggart was calling everybody a sinner on his television program, and he's getting caught in the Texas motels with the hookers, you know, and they're all robbing, you know, people on limited retirement incomes of their money, you know, for heavenly projects that don't exist. And, you know, I saw unbelievable hypocrisy in the religious community. And I, my distorted perception was, though that's God's front three. You know, they're out there, they're the loudest voice God has, and they're robbing people. You know, they're such hypocrites. I might be a crazy alcoholic, but I'm not robbing widows. You know what I mean? And that's the kind of perception I have. I saw two really bad examples of spirituality, and I painted the whole spiritual world with that brush. You can't come into this with those type of prejudices. You know, religion itself has way more good characteristics than it has bad. Of course, it's responsible for wars and all that stuff, but I mean, it's also responsible for the cohesion of our society. If you're getting married or somebody dies, I mean, you know, it's part of our culture. It's part of our heritage, and there's incredibly good things in it. And you know, what we don't want to do is we don't want to bring these old, bad, distorted belief systems into our spirituality of today. It's going to hurt you. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon a simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. This is the great news for us, for we had assumed that we could not make use of spiritual principles. I think I read this already. Besides a seeming inability to accept much on faith, we often found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touchy that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. Though some of us resisted, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. Sometimes this was a tedious process. We hope no one will be as prejudiced as long as some of us were. Again, you know, alcohol can be a persuader. One of the things that's a big concern of mine lately, it has to do with professional addiction treatment and alcoholism treatment. I'm on a couple of different boards, and I'm involved with some people who are fighting very, very hard for access to treatment for addictive illness and efficacious or effective addiction or alcoholism treatment. Now, what we have today is we have about 10% of the people that seek treatment are able to get it, and that's just not good enough. That's prejudiced against addictive illness as an illness. Because if you have heart disease, if 10% of the people got treatment with heart disease, you know, the world would stop, okay? But addictive illness is a much greater problem than heart disease or cancer put together. It's the number one health threat in America today is addictive illness. The numbers supersede cancer and heart disease put together. Now, in the beginning of addiction treatment, the very first rehabs that were put together were started by AA members, and they were called sober ranches. You know, they were called drying out farms. And what they would do is they would buy like a, you know, big farmhouse somewhere, and they'd bring 8 or 10 people in who just could not stop drinking. And it was basically Alcoholics Anonymous members, you know, Alcoholics Anonymousing these people. You know, and this is really how places like Hazleton and stuff like that started. They started with recovered members of the 12-step community. Now, some changes were made, you know, with insurance reimbursement. The Hughes Act came in. There was a number of different. The American Medical Association considered alcoholism and drug addiction a disease, so that made it incumbent upon reimbursement agencies to pay for it. Now it became a business. Now all of a sudden professionals are involved. And today what we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of MDs, PhDs, and psychiatrists driving the addictive illness treatment processes. Nothing could be worse than something like that. Trying to treat alcoholism, because it's a spiritual illness, trying to treat it like a mental health problem or a medical problem would be like trying to treat herpes with architecture. It's the wrong discipline, okay? There were better outcomes when the AAs brought people into these farmhouses. More people were getting sober than are getting sober today. It's like 5% recovery rates in some of these treatment centers. I was just working with a family where the kid went to 16 rehabs. Okay, what's the definition of insanity, Dave?
Repeating something that doesn't work.
Yeah, repeating something that doesn't work, hoping for a better outcome. We sent this person to one of those drying out places, which are coming back, where AA members house you and take you through the steps, and he's fine now. Now, why am I getting off on this tangent? I'm getting off on this tangent to say that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written in 1939. There's a lot of criticism about, oh man, this book was written in the 30s. You know, more will be revealed. You know, we've got all kinds of professionals now and CDACs and, you know, ASHRA, Addiction Society of Medical Doctors and all this stuff. None of it has increased recovery rates. All this new stuff has just made it worse. What they discovered back in the 30s with this material is that addiction is a spiritual malady. It needs a spiritual solution. The spiritual solution is the conscious contact of God, God working in and through you, placing you in the sunlight of the Spirit so that you can recover. That's the treatment for alcoholism, and that's what this book is talking about. And I am telling you, it says in here, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. That is still true today. The people who go through this book and do what this book says, there's over an 80% recovery rate for the people that do that. Rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly follows this path. Yet treatment centers that you pay $30,000 to go through have 5% recovery rates. You know? I'm part of a group of people who have an issue with that. Too many of us are dying because it's just easier to charge insurance companies if you do clinical mental health shit. You know? And that's how you make money. It's hard to charge money for A, that you're alcoholic and cannot manage your own affairs. B, that no human power can relieve you of your alcoholism. And C, God could and would if you were sought. Here's your bill. It's hard to do that. That's why we all need to become proficient with carrying this message. We need to carry this message to alcoholics that still suffer, because we're the only ones that can. You can go to the Betty if you want. It's not going to work. You know what I mean? We really have an answer. We really have. I'll let you fix this mess up.
It's like the beginning of Mission Impossible. We disavow any knowledge of this operation. You know, I was reading Not God on the plane. We were at down in Florida for an AA convention. I was reading Not God on the way home, and what struck me was I never actually knew just how much Dr. Silkworth had done with alcoholics. And in Not God, they give a nice little piece about what his history was, which I didn't know. He apparently, when he did his internship as a doctor in the local hospital, I think it was in Bellevue, actually. It was in Bellevue. They immediately noticed that he had an affinity for alcoholics. He liked us for some reason and was able to work with us. And he claims to, over his career, span many, many years, to have attended to 50,000 of us. Now, I did a quick some math in my head. That was two or three a day that he would attend to in his career. And he said that his success rate was about 2%. Now, that's not really a viable success rate, is it? All right? I would do better in prison, probably.
Better with placebos.
Yeah. they tasted good. And it's incredibly interesting for me that a man who had an affinity, who was both a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, and had the ability to really assess what was wrong with us in every way but our spiritual malady, because he didn't have the disease, right? He could point to time and time again how Dave would drink and have an immense amount of remorse 2 days later when he came out of the blackout, you know. And things had gone awry, and the wife was leaving, and nobody wanted to talk to him. And he can give, he could give a great description about how I would get, I would sober up and get separated, but inevitably I would return. And he didn't know about the spiritual malady because he didn't suffer from the spiritual malady. The problem was, I really had to suffer from that spiritual malady. I really had to know what that was at a gut level. I had to know how that had failed me. And the one area of science that actually helped me with God, as crazy as this might sound, was I came in here with a fairly scientific and investigative mind. That's part of what I do for a living, is investigate things. I drill down to find the facts. But when I came in here, I was absolutely undeniably sure that God did not exist, or did not exist for me. I absolutely was sure of that. I had no evidence to that effect, except for the manufactured evidence in my head. And I knew that just wasn't going to be part of what I was going to do. I was going to do inventory, I was going to hang out with you guys, and I was going to muddle through. And at some point, that became an insufficient solution. At some point, that just didn't work anymore. At some point, the rooms became a dull place to be, and you people started to bother me again. So what I did was I decided that I really had to have something more in my life. I had to apply a method to this because it wasn't working. So what I went on an investigative journey of God. That's crazy, right? You're shaking your head yes? That's crazy?
It's crazy.
It's crazy, yeah. And in statistics, you can never prove something to be true. But you can prove with a certain level of certainty that it's not false. So that's when I started out on my journey. So I started to look at the facts of my life. I started to try to find out where God was and wasn't in my life. Now I want you to imagine this. You're looking at a guy who had been kidnapped by Colombian drug dealers. They're not a friendly group. It's not the Lions Club. You know, they're not taking me out for coffee. You're talking to a guy who has placed himself in harm's way time and time again, and I wonder, it was funny because we were talking about this week, and I wonder how I got out of that. I used to attribute it to my own ability to manage and control the situation, and now I realized along the way, as I started to look at the facts of the situation, that I had been kept safe and protected, even though I was the fool in the situation. I was the only person in the situation who didn't know that he was being safe and protected. So I had to start looking at the what had happened in my life, and I took the God of reason I had when I walked through the door, and I started to apply it to the situation that was my life. And I started to find that I could not disprove certain things. And I started to walk down that path because I had to shed this prejudice. I had to become this was my course of willingness. Right? I couldn't just blindly take on faith. That was not my nature. I had to investigate. So I investigated everything, and I started to find that I couldn't disprove God in any aspect of my life. What I could do was I could set aside the preconceived notions. There was a great talk that I heard one time by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked about getting to God. And he says, getting to God is about getting up the mountain. And he goes, we're all going to hop on our own donkey to get up that mountain. And I don't have to ride your donkey. Your donkey can be a Jewish donkey, it can be a Christian donkey, it could be a Muslim donkey, it could be a Buddhist donkey, it could be a Wiccan donkey. You know, it could be a lot of things. Right? It doesn't matter how we get up the mountain. It matters that we're willing to get on the donkey and take the ride. Because it's not a matter of what brings me to God, it's a matter of my willingness to take the journey. And my journey was a journey of taking a moment to think about this stuff from a scientific point of view and to try to start to either prove or disprove the facts of my life, not the thoughts that I had. The reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. We think there are good reasons. Let us have a look at some of them. The practical individual today is a stickler for facts and results. When you go out to buy car insurance, do you just randomly pick a name from the book, from the phone book, or do you just go on the internet and go, well, they have a great website, I'm going to go with them? Or do you check the prices? Do you find out whether or not there's reviews? When you get a mortgage on your house, or you search for that divorce attorney, or you whatever you do, do you do a little work? Right? I'm a stickler for facts in every aspect about, except for my spiritual awakening. Right? There I'm just going to be prejudiced. So, right? No, it's not going to happen for me, so I'm not going to look at it. In every other aspect, I would take all the time in the world to figure out what's the best coffee shop, what's the best this, what's the best that. Nevertheless, the 20th century readily accepts theories of all kinds provided they are firmly grounded in fact. We have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everybody believes them without a murmur of doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it is impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. Everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions for which there is good evidence, but no perfect visual proof. I like that. And does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? It is being constantly revealed as mankind studies the material world that outward appearances are not inward reality at all. To illustrate, the prosaic steel girder is a mass of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speed. These tiny bodies are governed by precise laws. And these laws hold true throughout the material world. This is true. Science tells us so. We have no reason to doubt it. When, however, the perfectly logical assumption suggests that underneath the material world and life as we see it, there is an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence. Right there, our perverse streak comes to the surface, and we laboriously set out to convince ourselves it isn't so. And I do that because it conflicts with the world I built around me, the thinking I've built around me, because I've got to build that world so I can keep drinking. We read wordy books and indulge in windy arguments, thinking we believe this universe needs no God to explain it. Were our contentions true, it would follow that life originated out of nothing, means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, we agnostics and atheists chose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and end of all. Rather vain of us, wasn't it? We who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. Why do you think they say even against organized religion? How many alcoholics, when you walk through the door, are absolutely positive that they're wrong, right? How many times have I walked in here and said they're wrong, and I was absolutely sure, and I can tell you why. And organized religion to me was the last vestige of the things that I would ever, ever consider. We have learned that whatever the human frailties of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. We used to amuse ourselves as we cynically dissected spiritual beliefs and practices. When we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness, which we should have sought ourselves. Here's an interesting question. Anybody here remember Pat Benatar from the 80s?
I remember Pat Benatar.
So for Mark's, let's ask Mark. Do you remember the Bay City Rollers?
Of course I do.
Right. Who doesn't?
Because you were made for dancing.
That's right. 100 years from now, I'm fairly certain that unless you're an eclectic collector of music like Jim or Chris, you probably won't have the Bay City Rollers Golden Collection on your shelf. Right? But I'm going to walk in here, and I'm going to look at Judaism, which has been around for 3,000 years, 3,000 plus years, and go, nah, nothing valuable there. Survived 3,000 years before the internet, no less. right? I'm going to walk in here and say Christianity, Buddhism, right? I'm going to walk in here and say Islam, not for me. 1,500 years, ain't going to work for me, right? Somehow, I'm going to think the things that I think are going to outlive this stuff. But the reason that these practices and these faiths and the denominations of these faiths and the creeds exist today is because they have value. I just refuse to accept that they have any value. It is in the acceptance that there is value there that my life becomes richer. It is in acceptance of the value there that I set aside these preconceived notions. My life becomes more as I start to accept what other people see with great clarity, who don't apparently have resentments when they live their life. You know, 90% of the world is not alcoholic. The rest of us have resentments, right? That other 90% are easily able to see the value in the religion, either the one that they are raised in or the one that they find in their life. And there have been religions that have popped up over the years and slowly gone away. And you can read about them if you spend a little time, you know, little sects and groups of people who believe in something. You go, that's kind of odd, you know, when you read what they believe in. That doesn't make as much sense to me. But the tenets of the things that I find in the various major religions, even Hinduism, which I don't even understand that well, I find that there's this common thread throughout all these things, and these are the things that support this idea. And I have rejected this idea out of hand without any previous investigative work. Instead, we look at the human defects of these people and sometimes use their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. In the stories which follow, you will find wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether you agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. There are questions for each individual to settle for himself. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has, in each case, accomplished the miraculous, the humanly possible, impossible. As a celebrated American statesman put it, let's look at the record. Here are 100 men and women, worldly and sophisticated, indeed. They flatly declare to you that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward the power and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of thinking, their way of living and thinking. They tell you that in face of the collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resource, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction has flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they will show you the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, that they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They will show you how the change came over them. When 100 people, much like you, are able to say that consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why you too should have faith. One of the things that is always evident when I have the great honor of working with somebody new is that I remember the fear of what it was like when I walked the door. I remember the fear of what it was like having the absolute 100 forms of what I believe were fact in my life that this was not going to work for me. When I had all of that stuff going on and I knew that there was really simply no answer because I had searched long and hard inside of myself for an answer and the answer just didn't seem to stick. It didn't seem to last for any length or period of time. And one of the things that we do when we sit down and do the steps is that we sit down and do 1, 2, and 3 right away. Why do we do 1, 2, and 3 right away? Why don't we contemplate one for a year? Why don't we discuss one at the noontime open discussion meeting? You know? why don't we spend time rolling around, number one, like an egg roll? You know, why don't we, why not? Because the simple fact is that the answer is not going to come from inside of me. And one of the things that it tells me is that I've got to make it an admission process that this life that I've led, this experience that I've had, has been a failure for me. It doesn't say, right, that something else has failed me. It says that my life has become unmanageable. And if my life has become unmanageable, I probably have two choices. One is to turn myself over to you guys and get locked up, like Dr. Jung said, in Zurich to Roland Hazard, or to have make available to myself a power greater than myself. And it's the simple truth. And my sponsor carried to me the message that this is not a self-directed program. This is not a self-help program. It's never been a self-help program. There's never been a time where I've had the power to be a self-help program. It's always been a time of where I've got to avail myself of a power greater than myself. It's always been that. From the very first day. From the very first day that Dr. Bob came, you know, Dr. Bob went out to perform that surgery that he had to perform in Akron after coming back from Atlantic City drunk. So wasted they had to pick him up at the train platform at 4 a.m. in Cayuga Falls. You know, and 3 days later, he's going to be opening somebody up to perform a proctology operation. And that's a scary thought, right? Bill's pouring sauerkraut juice and a variety of other things into him to get him sobered up. What a great... That alone might do it, you know? But Dr. Bob goes out that day, and the one thing that he was unwilling... You know, Dr. Bob had completely abandoned the idea of God in his life. And he was an active member of the Oxford Group for 2 years before Bill showed up. But he went because he liked the nature of the people there. And it was a sense of relief to be with these people because they seemed to have a lightness of being and a faith that he wanted. And that was the only reason he went to the Oxford Group for the 2 years prior to Bill showing up. It was after Bill showing up and Bill explained to him about the process of deflation, right, and surrender that he started to get this. And it was after the operation when he didn't come home and they were all worried about him, but he was out making his amends. He went and found his creditors. He went and found the people that he had harmed. And he offered... He literally went out that afternoon to his creditors and says, I owe you this money, I want to pay it back, is this payment schedule okay? And Bill had given him a beer that morning to steady his hand for the operation. Now if that's not the power of God, I don't know what is, because I'm not going out and making those amends that day, right? But if he hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here. There would be no, you know, website, the Westfield Big Book Workshop. You know, there'd be no Chris sitting next to me. I might actually be in the bar next to you. Who knows? You know, kind of a couple of crazy guys. It's on that slim reed, that slim thread, you know, that it wasn't until that moment that Dr. Bob accepted into his life that he had to get this God thing, that he was able to actually go out and have a psychic change in his life. And he goes on to talk about for two more years, the craving for alcohol didn't leave him. Didn't leave him. And I have an opinion upon that, which is pretty useless, but, you know, Dr. Bob was a muncher of pills, too. He found that the patients didn't come around as often when they smelled alcohol in his breath at 10 o'clock in the morning. So he would take some pills in the morning to steady himself. And there wasn't really... No, that's not the kind of thing you want to talk about too much in a small town like Akron when you're trying to repair your doctor's practice. If it wasn't for Dr. Bob going out that day and actually accepting the fact that he needed to have a power greater than himself and that he was willing to do anything, including facing people who he had harmed, either financially or in other ways, and going and finding them that day and offering to make amends to them, that we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be contemplating the idea of a manuscript to miracles workshop. We wouldn't be contemplating the big book. You know, Bill probably would have gotten back on the train knowing it was a failure when it wasn't. Right? And it's in that moment that simple change from, Dr. Bob, a highly intelligent physician, deciding that it could not be within him, it had to be with God, that you and I have the grace of sitting here tonight. And I think we're going to end on that.
I got a couple things to finish with.
Go.
Okay. The Nobel Prize was just given out, and anybody that pays attention to that, it was a very, very interesting award to two scientists. And these scientists got the award for discovering what is called the God particle. That's not the scientific name for it, but that's what they call it. Through a particle accelerator in Europe, they discovered this subatomic particle that is part of the wave of energy that permeates the universe and creates mass. And they've discovered this in a particle accelerator. And so just one more piece to quantum mechanics and how that's answering a lot of the riddles of the universe. Bill Wilson talks about science being a block to believing in God or spirituality. I don't believe that. I think we can be sophomoric and think that the Earth was only, you know, was made by God 4,000 years ago. We can be sophomoric like that. Or we can look deeper into this. And there's one thing that I find incredibly amazing. And behind it has to be an intelligent design. And that is, after the Big Bang, and any legitimate scientist believes in the Big Bang today, after the Big Bang, there was this outrushing of matter, and it was basically all hydrogen. And what would happen is these hydrogen clouds would coalesce and they would form suns, like the one that we have. And all of this is basically hydrogen atoms. Now, what happens when a sun dies is it collapses upon itself, and it explodes into a red giant, and then it sends out matter. And through that explosion is where elements are created. You know, elements that have more than one electron or one neutron. All of the elements are manufactured through these exploding stars. Now, within us, we have complex molecules, and we have complex atoms, which means we are the stuff of exploding stars. Otherwise, we wouldn't exist. And I find something like that fascinating, number one. But I have to go back and I have to believe that there's an intelligent design behind all this cosmology. You know, I don't see it as science or spirituality. I see them both connected. And that has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about, Dave, but I wanted to talk about it because I like the way I talk about it. So with that, we'll quit.
With that, we'll put. And so we're going to open this up to comments, queries, concerns, and questions. We have 4 minutes.